If you're at all like me and don't especially like eating a bunch of chemicals, then ButcherBox is just what you're looking for. When you get a ButcherBox membership, you'll have the peace of mind that you're getting high-quality meat, seafood, and poultry that you can trust. With 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork that's raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood, ButcherBox wants you to eat healthier than you ever have before. More importantly, there's no antibiotics or hormones in their meat, which might not always be the case at one of those big box stores. Another huge bonus with ButcherBox? They conveniently deliver directly to your doorstep. Save yourself the hassle of driving to the supermarket, or even putting on pants for that matter. And ButcherBox's prices are competitive, or even lower than what you'll find at your grocery store. ButcherBox also has a slew of delicious recipes and other cooking tips to help add a little pizzazz to your meals. At our house, we've tried a bunch of different meals, and they've been a huge hit every time. They're really good. And right now, just for our listeners, ButcherBox is offering ground beef for life with a new membership, plus an additional 20% off your first order. Use the link butcherbox.com/lisk and use the code LISK to get free ground beef for life, plus 20% off your first box. Again, that's butcherbox.com/LISK, L-I-S-K, and use code LISK.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo. Murder and Silence in El Salvador, the story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro, ¿dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another bonus episode of the LISK Long Island Serial Killer Podcast. Whereas you've probably noticed that official Season 2 episodes have unfortunately come to a close, we will continue producing occasional LISK-related bonus content featuring case updates, topical tangents, and even some familiar voices, like that of today's guest, our Long Island area homicide detective, who has been an indispensable resource while investigating the LISK case and other cold cases that are currently on the MOPAC audio docket. He recently sat down with me on a return trip from Tennessee, where he talked about what it actually takes for law enforcement to process DNA, as well as best practices for working with web sleuths, and ways he imagines the LISK case might one day be solved.
So, what's up, dude? Like, you're in Tennessee? Tell me about that.
We just left Knoxville. We went to, my partner Mike and I, we went to the Body Farm, which we spoke about the other day. So we're there for a week, and now we have to drive back to Nashville for our flight.
Let's get down to the nitty gritty. Tell me, are there any real updates you can give me? Any sort of insight that maybe the public doesn't know?
I know the police commissioner in Long Island just changed over. So I would think that maybe there's new fresh eyes on the case. But as far as investigatively, not really sure. We did provide them with some information, which was spoken about in Season 2 of LISK with the person of interest. That information is now in the hands of investigators working the case. But as far as any insight I might have as to what's going on, I'm not really sure. I would assume that they're waiting on genealogy, still interviewing, you know, family members, working off tips received via their website or from phone calls. But other than that, I'm not really, you know, kind of in a loop on the case.
Yeah, sure. And that makes sense. You're not an SCPD cop or even a Nassau County cop.
What I can tell you is that at least genealogy, it takes a while. So by the time, you know, you have to get reference samples, you have to send those reference samples down to a different state, you know, typically Virginia or Florida or Texas. And those labs are swamped right now with cases. So law enforcement departments are paying to expedite this stuff, but it still takes weeks, if not months, to get results.
Could you tell me about that process a little bit and like how much it costs and what this backlog looks like? Because as we've talked about, it just sort of became legal to use genetic genealogy. So they have a backlog of DNA that they need to test. Can you talk about how expensive that is, what it looks like, you know, how much time it goes into all of this?
Yeah, especially for this case. So what New York would do is, firstly, they'd want to identify the unidentified remains. So I believe there's still a couple bodies that are still unaccounted for. And then once they eventually identify those people, they could, you know, basically have fresh leads to go off of. You take the reference sample, which is a DNA sample, typically a little card containing like a little spot of blood, which was taken during an autopsy. If there is not blood available, if it's pretty much a skeletal remains, they'll actually extract DNA from the bones. They'll send that, either drive it down or send it via like FedEx overnight to whatever lab they choose. Like I mentioned before, there's a lab in Virginia, there's a lab in Texas, there's a lab in Florida, at least that I know about. I'm sure there's more. Cost-wise, you're looking at anywhere between $3,000 and $10,000, I would say, depending on how many samples you're actually sending down. That's like a starting point. So first they have to actually process the DNA. They have to come up with a genetic profile. Once a genetic profile is then created, then typically that profile gets sent to a different lab, a lab that has a contract with the genealogy companies. So when you use genealogy, something like an Ancestry.com, 23andMe, those companies don't specifically share the DNA with law enforcement. They use a company called GenMatch, which matches your DNA with other people around the country. So for instance, if I did Ancestry.com, if I agreed to give my sample and to all the, you know, the fine print, when I get my results back, you'll actually see like people I'm related to, first cousins, second cousins, third cousins. And that's what GenMatch does. It just, everything just takes time. So once a profile is created, whether it be blood or from bones, it then gets transferred to another lab that has a contract with GenMatch. And then we kind of go from there and try to come up with some type of first cousin relative, if not a second cousin relative, of that DNA profile. You know, in totality, you're looking at anywhere between 3 to 6 months at a minimum.
And then who pays for that? Do taxpayers pay for that? Because I would imagine there's like hundreds of samples and backlog. And if they're at least, you know, let's say 10K a pop, if not more, you know, that's a lot of money.
Absolutely. Different variety, different resources. Sometimes government grants. I know, like, for instance, my office right now, we're working on a government grant for cold case that we're hoping to get, which will provide a lot of funds to test, basically just for DNA testing on cold cases, whether it be grants, whether it be budgetary. Some departments have money to spend, but it definitely can get costly, especially when you're sending a lot of evidence, you're sending a lot of DNA reference samples. For instance, we just sent a case down to a private lab right now. I can't really discuss the details of the case, but it's getting costly because once we were able to successfully get DNA, now we have to compare that DNA to several different suspects, and every time you compare it to a different suspect, it incurs new costs. So it's definitely getting expensive.
Yeah, people get really confused around topics of DNA, and it's just very helpful to have, you know, a law enforcement source like yourself to clarify all of that. Let's quickly pivot to outside, you know, sources, like people who submit tips, and how someone in law enforcement like yourself relates to these tips. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so a lot of leads, pretty much from the start, you can vet them out pretty quickly. If there's something of substance, such as the, you know, the POI file, which is over 200 pages, that alone kind of caught my eye, the fact that somebody put that much time and effort into basically a presentation on somebody they thought might be involved in the list case. Now, there's a good chance that that person, the POI, has already been vetted out. It's definitely possible. I would think so. But there's also that chance that, you know, the file got pushed to the side and may never be looked at again. A case like Lisk is it's a pretty high profile case, especially on the East Coast. Every, you know, few months, few years, you consistently seeing articles come out about the case, which pretty much generates more tips. A lot of the tips, at least from cases I've worked, are just so far out there that, you know, it's not even worth putting effort into. But they're, you know, typically you might get lucky, you might get some good leads to run down. That's what I would think that the FBI is doing right now and has been doing for the past almost 12 years.
So can you talk about what your relationship is to, for lack of a better term, web sleuths or online researchers? Like, how has that helped you, and how has being a homicide detective sort of changed in terms of investigation techniques, like over the past 20 years or so?
Well, as far as your first part of the question about web sleuthing and things like that, I mean, we're always open. Most people I work with are open to hearing the general public. If somebody has an idea or somebody has a tip, we're always willing to listen, to sit down with people. I know in the past we've sat down with authors of books. We've sat down with, you know, just general citizens that want to put their input into specific cases. But over the past 5 years, just working homicide cases, everything's completely changed. It's almost on a 180. So from like 2008 to 2015, most cases were very cell phone heavy, meaning cell phones typically would solve a lot of investigations, tracking information, historical location information, things like that. They still do, but now with all these different applications, such as like WhatsApp and TextNow and these free applications and paid applications, it's getting more and more difficult to track messaging, to work on work with companies like Google, Apple, iCloud, any type of iCloud companies, like not just Apple, but anybody that stores data. We write court orders and we obtain that data, so we can go back and we can see what websites people went to, their historical location information. So, for instance, you know, last September, where were they on this date and time? We can kind of see if the phone was on, where that person or whoever was using that phone, where that phone was. The things, you know, over the past 5 years are changing, and I would expect that to change even more. I think what hurts the list case a little bit is that a lot of these applications and social media and things like that didn't exist in 2010 like they do now. Or they did, but they weren't as involved in pretty much everyone's life. I know Facebook was around, but you know, not nearly as many people had Facebook as they do today, let alone 5 years ago. So everything's pretty much changed. So I think if the list case happened today, I feel confident that it would be a lot easier to solve than it was back in 2010, let alone bodies were found in 2010, 2011. These crimes happened, some of them in the 90s, so you're going back even farther, which makes it even more difficult. So things definitely evolved, at least in my field.
You may have heard that Shopify has been helping millions of people sell their products online. But did you know that Shopify is helping stores around the world sell in person too? Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. It's easier than ever to do everything from accepting payments to managing inventory, so when customers search for that thing they want, it's there. Shopify has everything you need to sell to your customers in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse partner that can track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. It's easier than ever to connect with customers online and in line, too. Shopify helps drive sales with their intuitive plug-and-play tools to get the word out on TikTok, Instagram, and pretty much any other social platform. Shopify has the hardware that'll fit your business. Take payments by phone, turn your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device to alleviate all those sales headaches. And if you ever run into problems, Shopify's award-winning support team is there to smooth things out. Do retail right with Shopify. So sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/lisk. That's L-I-S-K, all lowercase. Again, go to shopify.com/lisk to take your retail business to the next level today. One last time, go to shopify.com/lisk.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The highly anticipated second season of the hit podcast Proof is finally here. Proof is an investigative true crime podcast co-hosted by Susan Simpson of Undisclosed and Jacinda Davis of Evil Lives Here. Proof made headlines for its first season in 2022 after proving the innocence of two Georgia men serving life sentences for murdering their friend Brian Bowling when they were just 17 years old. 25 years later, on December 8th, 2022, both men were finally freed based on evidence unearthed by Proof. In the second season of Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, Susan and Jacinda are on the case again, this time traveling the streets of Manteca, California, to uncover who really murdered 18-year-old Rene Ramos. On June 5th, 2000, Ramos's body was found buried under a pile of debris inside the shell of a new Home Depot building. Despite tips hinting at alternate suspects, tips that were ignored until now, Renee's boyfriend, 18-year-old skater Jake Silva, and Ty Lopez, the 33-year-old uncle of one of Jake's close friends, were arrested and convicted of her murder. Fans of true crime and investigative series won't want to miss this riveting new season. Follow the case as Susan and Jacinda uncover long-overlooked evidence about what really happened to Renee by listening to Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's talk about cold cases. What is kind of the life cycle of a cold case? When does it turn cold? And what is law enforcement looking for in terms of when to resurrect cold cases?
So we typically anywhere between 3 and 5 years. But if there is a suspect on a case, we won't consider it cold. A lot of times, a lot of the cold cases have great suspects that police like. But A, police are not going to go to the press and release the name of the suspect. And B, they're not going to, they potentially may have enough to indict a case in grand jury, but they don't feel confident that they're going to win the case in the courtroom. So an arrest is never made. So it just depends. For us, I would say between 3 and 5 years. But there's, you know, there's cases that there's people that we like for the crime. We're right there, but we just need a little bit more. I think that's a lot of the cold cases out there today. I know, at least by me, when things get slow, sometimes detectives will just pick up a cold case, and it's great just to have a fresh set of eyes on a case. Sometimes there's, you know, people you could identify that were never interviewed. There's items that could be tested or retested. DNA testing has definitely changed over the past 20 years. So now we have greater capabilities than we had back in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, the 2000s. We have a lot more low copy DNA, which a lot of people call touch DNA, which we can test now, and then even if we get bad samples, there's actually ways of enhancing those samples using like an item called like a star mixture or something like that, where it'll enhance, potentially separate the DNA profile, and then we'll get a better opportunity to take that profile, put it into CODIS, potentially match to a suspect. So everything's pretty much, like I mentioned before, everything's pretty much changed, but every department works cold cases differently. I think it's a great thing just to have fresh eyes on the case. A lot of times people already have made conclusions on cold cases where they've zoned in on one suspect and they kind of get tunnel vision. And once you have tunnel vision, it's kind of hard to come out of. And, you know, sometimes the person that you like for the crime isn't necessarily the person that did the crime.
Yeah. And I was going to ask, does public interest in cold cases help kind of light a fire under law enforcement to sort of start looking into them again?
Absolutely. It not only fuels investigation, it also depends on who's running the department, but not only will fuel the investigation, it might generate new tips and leads. There's things you can do now that, you know, we couldn't do 5-10 years ago. For instance, like Google searches. Sometimes when people commit crimes, they go back and they constantly, or consistently look up articles on the crime. So maybe, you know, if you have a serial killer and say that individual's killed 10 people and you know that most of these crimes are related, you could actually write a court order to Google and start looking for keyword searches that somebody may have done. So for instance, if there was a murder in New York City, there was one in Atlanta, there was one in Nashville, there was one in LA, and there was one in, I'm making up a town, but Jackson, Arizona. Jackson, Arizona might be a small little town. If somebody's Google searching all those little towns and looking up the keyword murder along with those towns, Google could provide the user profile for that person, and it might be an investigative lead. It might be, you know, it might be a web sleuth, but it also might be somebody that, you know, was involved in those crimes and wants to see if any new articles or new information comes out about the crimes. Maybe, you know, maybe they walk around looking with their head over their shoulder because, you know, deep down inside they know they're responsible and know that any day they can get ripped out of bed at 6 a.m. by a SWAT team. So, yeah, I think, you know, back to your question, Shannon, I think definitely fuels investigations, especially little, like not high profile cold cases are almost better to put out there because people don't know about them as much. There's less press. So now when you're really putting it out to the press, you're really generating new information. And then sometimes that information leads to podcasts, TV shows, things like that, Reddit message boards. So yeah, it's definitely a good thing.
So just to sort of put a button on all of this, if you could give advice to web sleuths, online researchers out there who would like to submit tips to local law enforcement or whomever, what is the best way to do it?
Sure. I would not submit an email or online tip. I think a lot of those get kind of brushed away or missed. Get on the phone and get in contact with somebody. You could always start with the detective bureau in the town where the crime happened. If it is a federal case, you can always contact the FBI, the local FBI branch. You can simply Google search the town and FBI, and the nearest branch will come up. But I wouldn't just email or submit a tip online. I would physically pick up a phone, contact somebody. And then there's other things you could do too. For instance, like with the List case, you know, Webster's went out there and built his own website, which came out great. And that generates information, generates interest, and I'm sure he receives tips as well. So you could even take it to that level if you wanted to. Like I mentioned, I wouldn't submit tips online. I would definitely call, contact, and then when you contact, get the name of the person you spoke to, and then maybe a few months down the line, place another call and see if there was any results or see if they can give you any information on, you know, the information that you provided to them. Otherwise, as a web sleuth, I would assume you want to know that the information was vetted out.
That's great. Great advice. And I think the List community would find that invaluable, because especially with online researchers and web sleuths, we have nobody to bounce ideas off of. We don't really know if we're onto something. And to have a resource like you is invaluable to give perspective and tell us what's up and what's down. So I appreciate that and look forward to speaking to you again.
That sounds good.
This has been a MOPAC audio production. Executive producers are Jonathan Nauzarden and Jonathan Beal. This episode was written and hosted by me, Shannon McGarvey. Thank you for listening.